chip pan more than half full of oil or fat will bubble over when you add the chips and then catch fire. If this happens to you, first, turn off the heat. Second, run a tea towel under a tap and wring it out till it's damp. Then place it over the flames. Finally, leave the pan alone until it's completely cooled down. Of course, if you don't overfill your chip pan, you won't have to do any of this. Fire. If you don't let it start, you won't have to stop it.
Hello, this is the Extra Hot Grape Podcast, episode 353 for the week of May 3rd, 2021. I am Chip Band Death Trap David T. Cole, and I'm here with Institutional Starch Sarah D. Bunting.
Just add water.
Pot Noodle Tara Ariano.
Saltier than pure salt.
And Flash Frozen Fish Finger Alex Collins.
The least disgusting thing you'll eat in the 1950s.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to a special episode of Extra Hot Gray. You may remember 20 years ago or so, we had a thing on social media that was at program EHG hashtag, where we challenged you to come up with a 6-word pitch for a special episode. And if we picked your pitch, you would then get to program said episode. And we're here finally with that episode. It is Nice British People Doing Nice Things is our theme today from Heather. Mostly British things with a little Commonwealth twist towards the end.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So with that in mind, let's get right to it with our lead topic. Take it away, Tara.
Well, first we should welcome our guest. It's Alex Collins. Hello, Alex!
Alex!
Hello!
Welcome back.
Thank you very much.
Alex is closer than any of the rest of us to Britain, so of course that's why we had to invite her.
Geographically.
Yes. Yeah. So we are...
One person on the panel has British citizenship.
That's true.
It's not me.
No, it is
FYI.
Dave. He is always lording it over the rest of us. So our lead topic is Back in Time for Dinner. It's a British pop anthropology series featuring host slash narrator Giles Corran and food historian Polly Russell. So in 2015, the very game and I'm going to say very patient Robshaw family, parents Brandon and Rochelle and their children Rosalind, Miranda, and Fred, agree to experience what food and life generally sort of was like during 5 previous decades and for the finale, an attempt to predict the future. And so they allowed the production to transform their home, supply them with period wardrobes, and force them to live as people did during the decade they're taking on, though the means through which the era is primarily experienced is through food. And so we each chose the episode slash decade that most appealed to us. Let us do the Chen check-in. Alex, should our listeners watch Back in Time for Dinner?
Absolutely.
Okay. Sarah?
Yes, absolutely.
Dave?
This was Heather's favorite show, and I can see why. It is really fun, and I just wish it was on a proper place on the internet where you can watch them all, because Dailymotion doesn't cut it.
No. Yeah, we had to watch it on Dailymotion. I'm going to say no, it's not so much for me, but I'm glad that all the I didn't hate it, but I wouldn't go out of my way to watch more of it probably. So why don't we go through the episodes chronologically. Alex, the keener, actually watched 2. So why don't you go first? You watched 1950s.
And why I watched both, because I started with the 90s, because I figured that would be what I sort of related to the most, is kind of being a kid and teenager in the 90s. But then I felt that was maybe cheating a little bit. So I wanted to go back and then watch the 50s. And I have to say, like, I did really, really enjoy the show. I felt it was such an interesting take on, like, almost this mini history lesson documentary, but sort of through how and what people ate. And you got to learn about that decade and that point of time through food. And you learned about sort of culture and family and how that sort of all worked in that decade. And what I found really neat about the 50s, and I was really glad I went and watched it after, because when you watch the show, it takes a day is every year. So it's even interesting to see how that decade progresses. In the 50s, you saw such a huge change from 1950 to 1959. Mm-hmm. And like when you started, the first 3 years was still rationing after the war in Britain. So right. the children pretty much did not eat for the first 3 days. And I cannot blame them because the food was absolutely horrifying. It was literally pork drippings on national bread. And national bread was just like bread made from husks of wheat.
Oh,
and every person, you had an allotment of 5 ounces per person per week of the worst cuts of meat, of like organ meat, liver, and every person got 5 ounces every week. And that was it. So, and, but something that was interesting when you talked about this, the show took little like segments into deep dives of different parts of life. And one thing they looked at during the rationing was how school meal programs, though, were really instituted by the government so that children at least were getting one solid healthy meal a day. And so it was neat. And all of the children, it still didn't look super appetizing, but they commented all the children complained, but they all ate it.
Right.
So the government must have known they were doing something right. But you could see with the family in 1954, when rationing ended, it was like this little micro experiment of everyone was so much happier in this family after 3 days of living that way. So, you know, if you think about it, after years of living, I mean, the children, they were in their little video confessional, they're like, life is so much better because they didn't eat for 3 days. And suddenly then they had white bread and mm-hmm. sweets and real meat and different things that they just found. It was, everyone was happy again when they were just miserable for the first few days of the experiment.
You see that again in the 70s as well, to a lesser extent, when like you realize that the 70s was sort of the dawn of the snack, like the after school snack. Mm-hmm. And the youngest kid, the son, Fred, I think his name is.
Yeah.
Is like so relieved that like crisp packets are like a thing again, finally in their 70s household. Like he just looked like Ren in Ren and Stimpy, like just like the eyes, like there's a big basket of crisps. But all of these things that you just sort of take for granted as like the customs of the food world that really weren't, de rigueur until a certain point. That was fascinating to me. And also just visually, this is a feast. I was very happy for Dave at all the different fonts in this show.
It's true. I was surprised, Tara, that you said you didn't like it, because for me, this was sort of akin to that first shopping trip in a new grocery store where mm-hmm. it's like, oh, look at that thing. Or, you know, going grocery shopping in some foreign place or something like that, where you see all the weird local products. It had a taste of that. And that part I really enjoyed. And yes, they did a pretty good job bringing back the old packaging. Like some of it mm-hmm. was vintage packaging, but some of it, you know, they were just sticking a label on an old looking label on something new. But, you know, it was convincing enough. I did enjoy that part, too.
My favorite part was the old ads, because at least in the mm-hmm. 70s, that's definitely, there's more food advertising for like food products, like prepared foods. And that was very adorable, like how British foods were advertised to British citizens. But anyway, was there more to say about the 50s, or should we move on to the 70s?
Yeah, just I had one or two other little things. And one piece building on what you were saying with the ads, too, that was interesting with the 50s was the evolution of appliances. And when they started mm-hmm. the 50s, nobody had a refrigerator.
Right.
But by the mm-hmm. end of the 50s, it was this sort of the advent of consumerism of your kitchen appliances and really targeting housewives. So you went from not having a fridge to it was getting everything on, quote, higher purchase on credit. And then Mary Berry made a guest appearance as a salesperson from Place of, she used to, yeah, model for the electric range to appeal to the housewives. But the last thing was really interesting, and it was something that when the topic came up that was in sort of the brief was it being a really feminist forward show. And that was something that became really evident in the 50s episode, because they talked about, you know, housewives spend an average of 75 hours on domestic chores per week in the 1950s. And by now, we're a family together spends 18 hours per week on domestic chores. And the daughters had to take housecraft as part of school during the 1950s. And mm-hmm. the daughter, Roz, observed, and I had to write the quote down because it made my week of, she said, I have to do something for my entire life that I hate. I'm not very good at it. And I didn't get paid for it.
Yeah.
Like, yep. That sums it up for me.
Welcome to life.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
But it was great. Yeah. And even the food evolution part of it was interesting, too. And we talked about like fish sticks. That was an option because they figured out how to flash freeze food by the end of the 1950s. So I just liked all of those little sort of detours it took to explain history of just living in that point of time as a family and what it was like.
Mm. Yeah,
all right, Sarah, same. tell us about the 70s.
Well, the 70s, you have a lot of the same concerns because then you have everyone getting a deep freeze and like going to the freezer foods only shop.
Which is called Iceland.
So good. And then everything is sort of like out in salad bar style, but in a freezer case. And you it's like being in a candy shop and you weigh out like however many frozen carrots. But there's also that effortless folding in of everything that's influencing it culturally and everything that it is influencing culturally, like the fact that this is the point at which Roz gets to get a job, at which she's obliged, at which she is obliged to use a manual typewriter. And she's like, this is horrible. And yet at least I'm out of the house. But then when she gets home, it's sort of like the early to mid 70s at that point, but she is still expected to do all the meal prep and cleaning and stuff. And then she has this really funny monologue about how everything, like all the housewares in the kitchen, like the flower pots and the pickled onion jars, that she's like, everything has a face on it and it's trying to convince me that I'm happy to be here, but I already worked a full day. And why is this flower container that got flour everywhere? And the husband as well is sort of like, well, you know, I've had an easy ride so far, but I think the fun's over in the 70s, except like not really, because he and the kids are playing a board game and she's in the kitchen until the power goes out because of the miners' strikes. And like this was a part of British history in the last century that I either didn't know at all or had forgotten about. And the way they folded that in, I thought was really great. They never sort of lingered too long on any one topic. It was definitely a considered use of the period clothes and the period fonts. Mary Berry also shows up in the 70s at around 1971, because I think she wrote some like cooking for deep freeze thing. And, you know, it was nice to see her. I don't mind Prue as much as some people do, but Mary Berry is a global treasure.
Every specialty cookbook from the 70s looks like that, though. It is sort of like your browned and muted green main photo, white serif lettering up top.
Disgusting. Like just like the brown filter of the 70s. And at first, they're all sort of marveling at like that orange, as the husband says. And this is another show where this is another British unscripted show where their music budget is bonkers to me. Like they get really good music. And so does the Great Pottery Throwdown. Like you can afford the Who? You're a show about bowls. Okay. This was super enjoyable. And I definitely want to keep watching other future installments, because I think it's so thoughtful about how this looked on the ground. It's not just like a bunch of visual aids or like kitsch. It's really thinking about how the food and the family table is a reflection of the culture and the world around it. So I thought it was great. And I also didn't feel like it was homeworky. So yeah, that was the 70s.
Yeah.
The only thing I will say about the house, though, is that they did that thing where the 70s house is 100% 70s house, not a house you lived in the 70s with the history that comes in with living in a house. Like, I get it. It's the premise, but it would have been nice if they sort of blended the 50s into the 60s and the 60s into the 70s. So it felt like the house was evolving and not changing wholesale every decade. But, you know, minor complaint.
Yeah.
Yeah. The other thing that I learned, I mean, I knew about the miner strike just from watching The Crown, because it comes up on that.
And a little bit, the little Fred gets buried in a coal landslide, this dark episode.
I mean, he shouldn't have been there. Anyway, they talk a lot about, Polly, the food historian, goes to a food lab and learns about, like, food science.
Yeah.
And how they make flavors and stuff, and how it's like, well, this is maybe not great for our diets. And, you know, they show old footage from the time where a food scientist of the era is like, well, a lot of this is artificial and we don't really know how that's going to affect things. It's like, well, we do now.
Yeah.
Not great, but.
And it was totally unregulated. And then they just sort of move through macrobiotics and fondue and a bunch of other food crazes that some of them stuck around and some of them didn't. But
yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it made me want fondue, I'll tell you that much. David never had it. But when they showed him, like, sticking it in the big gob of bread with all that Swiss cheese, like, oh, fondue is so good.
It's great.
But the other thing that I was so happy for the Robshaws was in the late 70s, another thing that happened in Britain, because there was such a big influx of refugees from Bangladesh, is that there is an explosion of Indian restaurants. And so they get to go to an Indian restaurant and they talk about how, like, this is how chicken tikka masala became the national dish of Britain. Like, it's, you know, Indian food is basically British food at this point.
And the husband was, like, almost weeping. He was so happy to have, like, spicy food that had a taste, because, like, some of the frozen food, like, they would just be at dinner parties that the production made them have, staring down at their plates like, well, that happened, because, you know, they're being very British about it. American kids would have rioted, I feel pretty sure.
They were saying when that wave hit, and at this point, like, the menus, they were saying there was half Indian food and half British staples. And the mother orders, and she orders it in a way that I feel like you could still do that today. And it feels like something that is trashy, but I would totally be into. Whatever Indian dish he had, and then half rice, half chips. And I would be so into having a little mound of French fries with my Indian food, because it would goes really well with everything. It's just potatoes.
Yeah.
And I feel like I want to find a place that will do that for me here.
Speaking of chips, you've got to talk about the scary chip pan.
Yeah.
Because you selected that PSA for our opening clip.
Oh, my God. Right. That was terrifying. I really felt like something bad was going to happen to everyone.
So before the advent of oven fries, apparently, which it never occurred to me that was a relatively recent
product. No, me either.
It was. They would basically have a wire basket. You put a whole bunch of lard into a pot, and you would put your cut potatoes into this wire basket on the stove. And it wasn't like a big deep fryer. It was just like a saucepan or something like that.
Yeah.
And you would put these fries in and hope the oil didn't bubble over and catch fire on the burner and burn your house down. And that clip up top was the PSA they had on the show, snippet of it, but there's like four or five more I instantly found. So it was like this big campaign for the government. Don't overfill your chip pot or you will die. And there was a 1990s or early 2000s version of that. So they redid it. The exact same advice, except it's a fireman doing the get the towel, wet it, wring it out so it's just damp, put it over the pot, whatever you do, don't throw more water on it.
Right.
As it's being narrated by this woman. And the last shot is the one they pan from the set into the narrator's booth, and it's a woman who did that, and her face is all melty. She got no nose.
Oh my God.
But the
past
thing is
terrible.
Yeah.
But the reason they had to do that, they explain in the show, is that, like, it was a huge epidemic problem of, like, people burning their houses down because they were such a fire hazard. And Rochelle says, like, when she's like, I guess this is how we have to make chips. Because the other thing that happens is they have menus that they are ordered to cook. I'm not ordered, but they're like, this is what you're making today based on real menus of real, you know, housewives of the time. And she, because she was a child in the 70s, is like, still has fear of chip pans. And so she's like, she's so tentative cooking. Yeah. She's like,
so that's already happening. And then because of the the rolling blackouts, everybody, like, there was a run on camp stoves, and like that was the other part at which I was like, and we're not getting to the 80s in the show because they're trying to build a camp stove, and like the rest of the family is like, dad, that's upside down, dad. He's like, it's fine.
And it wasn't just the building. It was that he turned the gas on and waited so long before he lit it. Like, I was like, there's going to be a giant fireball from that. Like, how do you not know? Gas, immediately light it. Don't let the gas just build around the house. Oh, I felt like that family was.
So this was not an unmemorable television program, is what we're saying.
So
how often do you get like food history and science and actual danger in the same show?
Yeah. All right, Alex, tell us about the 90s.
Sure. And I will say before I move to the 90s, Dave, I have had in London chips with curry.
Yeah.
And it is amazing. And I highly recommend. So good. Now that's all I want. And I'm stuck here in St. John's.
Mm. Okay. Be right back, guys.
So the 90s, I that's where, like I said, where I started, because it was sort of what I figured I could relate to the most. And I did enjoy it. And to what Sarah was talking about, the music was amazing. And I made a note. It was Oasis and Blur and Pulp. And it was incredible. But it was, and again, just in the interesting part of the context and the history and how they wove it in, you know, Mad Cow was a big topic for the family that time because of what they could eat. And they had a whole conversation and then sat down for a steak dinner. So, and you know, there was different parts to it, but the thing that I really enjoyed was the impact and evolution of large scale grocery stores in the 90s. And that was really the advent of that time. And as a little bit of a grocery store aficionado, I love a good grocery store. And I miss, I think the most about Texas is going to the Central Market.
That's what I like about Texas.
That is what I like about Texas. But the other piece too that I felt was really interesting from the 90s was, in addition to the, you know, talking about grocery stores and food prep, like you talked, and that was something that I think evolved through the whole series and every decade. And we're going to go back as a family now and watch the full series. And there is a Canadian version on the CBC Gem app. They recreated it, like most Canadian reality television shows are based off of former BBC and British properties. But that was something that I think they've really focused on decade to decade, was meal prep and how, you know, it went from sort of that kind of theory of farm to table to pre-packaged, pre-made foods. And a stat that they gave out at the time was, you know, in the 1960s, it was 100 minutes to prepare your main meal. But by the 1990s, it was 23 minutes to prepare your meal. And I just loved how they wove through those parts and those details throughout the series. But the other thing they talked about in the 90s too was how restaurants and takeout became common rather than special treats. You know, before the 90s, it was rare that you went out for dinner, but the kind of the gastro pub sort of revolution changed that in the 90s. And
right.
But yeah, those were the things that I found was really interesting about the program, is how they just took it, weaved it all sort of through, and you learn something, but it was within the context of what it meant for everyday life.
Yeah. Yeah, it was rad. There was a lot of stuff that's like, oh, of course that's so. Like, of course that's true. That, you know, X hasn't always been like Y. But it took this show being like, just a reminder, there's not a microwave. Like, just a reminder, the kids get home from school and there's basically nothing to eat until tea. And they can't be on their phones.
Right.
And they're all just sort of like, I guess we'll play this dumb game. Like, and then the lights go out and they're like, fuck. I mean, they were all super good sports or British about it. I guess that's sort of the same thing. But yeah, I mean, I really think the show is great. And I hope that someone besides Daily Motion gets the rights to it. Because, I mean, it is really, it's soothing, but not like boring, soothing, just soothing.
Yeah, I loved it. We will watch it again. I thought it was great. And the family was really charming.
Yeah, yes. That's true.
Thank you, Heather. It was a great recommendation.
Yeah.
It is time for Around the Dial. Tara and Sarah have prescribed shows from Heather that they will talk about. And Alex and myself, we're allowed to find our own Zen British goodness. So, Tara, let's start with you.
Okay. I was assigned to watch Escape to the Chateau. This is on Peacock if you're in the U.S. and it features the extremely Britishly named Dick Strawbridge.
Oh, no.
And his partner, Angel. He is an engineer. She's an interior designer. They were originally just going to buy a cottage somewhere in France, but then they discovered that for their budget, which is £300,000, they had a lot more buying power in France. So they decided to think bigger, and they spent several years shopping for a chateau, like literally a castle, for those who did not take French in high school. And part of the idea is that once the place is fixed up, Angel will be able to use it as an event space, like host weddings there and stuff. So they find a place in Martigny-sur-Mayenne, right as it's coming on the market. This place has been in the family, like, since it was built until now. And it was built in the 1860s. It's 5 stories, 45 rooms. It's on several acres. I forget if they said 10 or 12, but a bunch. It also has a walled garden and several outbuildings. There have been some improvements. There was electricity, but there's also evidence that there was an electrical fire at some point. There's plumbing, but the sewage is not to any kind of code, as in the toilet flushes into the moat. There's also a moat, and no one has lived there in a very long while.
That's what makes the moat the moat. We're like, right. Well, we could get some sharks or we can get some shit.
There's shit fish that live in it. We see them swimming up. So it's like, well, they're shit eating fish. Something. Anyway, so they spend $280,000 of their $300,000 budget on the property. So they essentially have no savings left to spend on renovations. Like, literally, they buy a water heater / radiator system, like only enough gear to heat 5 rooms out of 45. And that alone costs $18,000. And the drill to try to get through the solid stone walls to install the pipes is another $1,500. And then it doesn't even work. Like, the walls are like, no. And they're like, well, that's $1,500. We don't have any more, I guess. 1,500 pounds. So then the plan is to get the place minimally plumbed, heated, which they take possession sometime around or just after Christmas when they show them in their apartment packing up. The tree is still up, so it's winter.
Oh, God.
And wired so they can move in. And they hope this will take 3 weeks because they've rented a cottage for that long.
Adorable.
I know all of us who have homes are like adorable. This guy's an engineer. He should know better. But anyway, yeah, it doesn't because really. This place is a fucking death trap. Like, when Dick is there, he finds out you could literally fall through the floor as soon as you step inside the front door. Like, he has to rig something up. Like, he looks through a tile comes through and he's like, oh, there's the floor and there's nothing below. Like, the insulation is straw and mud, literally. And it's falling apart.
Boy.
Angel's barely at the house because they also have 2 small children, you guys. She's looking after them. Well, one of them is a babe in arms still. So she's looking after them at this rental place while Dick is doing what he is able to and directing the expert workers who are doing the stuff he doesn't know how to do. By the way, he doesn't speak French. And when she shows up, she's like, we can put our bookshelves here with a ladder and we'll have to put an outlet here for the Christmas lights. And he's like, totally, but currently we cannot shit in here, so priorities. Except he's not that mean. That was me. But anyway, later she shows up the day before. She thinks they're moving in and is all excited to clean because it gives you such an instant feeling of, she says, satisfaction. And between and him having to point out to her, since she somehow can't see for herself, there kind of isn't anything for her to clean. And then she goes and like shuts herself in a room to pout. I kind of hate her. Anyway, ultimately, they don't meet even their modest deadline. And the family's moving into the house when it's still very much an active building site. Like, the radiator water heater system thing is not working. I don't think the toilet is either. Did I mention the 2 small children? So I found this show very stressful. Like, I can see where it would be soothing if you approach it with the right mindset, which is it wouldn't be a show if it didn't work out.
If anyone died, yeah.
Right? Like, they would not put these fools on TV if, right, exactly, if someone did fall through the floor. But anyway. On top of all that,
an alligator ate the baby, just like came up out of the moat, like
an alligator in France. Don't worry about it.
Well,
anyway,
that's our episode next. It also BBC2.
It seems very irresponsible and kind of gross for a family of 4 to buy a 45 room house. Like, How often do you read about these like British landed gentry who are like having to sell off pieces of, like, this is the whole thing about the later seasons of Downton Abbey, where it's like, we can't afford to literally heat this property because it's too big. Anyway, the voiceover keeps calling it a fairy tale and like leaning in on the romance of it. But like, this is a gross, excessive house for the number of people who are going to be living in it. Like, I guess if you're going to make it an event space, but even if you do that every weekend of the year, there's still 30 rooms you're never going to go in, but you still have to furnish them in case anyone like goes in when you're having a wedding there. Like,
also, here's an event, taking a crap.
Right. For example,
like, I'm just saying, are you going to go onto one of your acres and take a dump?
What?
You
can, maybe, I mean, that's what the moat is for.
Apparently, the fish are like, we got notes.
It's going to be. I unless you're deciding to make this place a hotel, I don't know why you would decide to buy this place. So if this sounds like it's for you, I get it. But I watched one. It was like, never again. So that's Escape to the Chateau.
I kind of want to watch that because it sounds like, what's it? It's with Mindy Page, Davis Page.
Oh, Trading Spaces?
Yes. Like Crying Pam on that. But like, but every week, and no one's quite crying because they're British and also they don't speak French. But like, I don't know. That sounds hilarious to me because I bought a money pit and moved into it before we fixed it up. And I find this like strangely familiar.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
In a scab picking kind of way.
Sure.
Maybe I shouldn't watch it. Anyway.
I mean, the first season's only three episodes, so.
No, all right.
I feel like it's a show I will watch the last episode when it's all done, and I can look at it and it'd be pretty and not have to deal with the stress, because I'm feeling tense just you talking about it.
And they could just do in flashbacks where both the kids got tetanus from falling through the foyer. Yeah. Excuse me, le foyer.
For my plug, Apple TV Plus turned The Mosquito Coast into a TV series starring Justin Theroux, which is nice because his uncle wrote the book. So I reviewed that for Primetimer, and you can find the link to that in the show notes.
Alex.
So I went to my trusty CBC Gem app that now I've talked about twice in the episode, so you're welcome. Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, to find a good sort of BBC British feel-good show. And I stumbled quickly upon Life Beyond the Lobby. And it was of interest because in my pre-pandemic life, I was a pretty regular business traveler. And occasionally we get to some US and European cities. And I always loved exploring and just taking public transport and walking the streets and seeing the sights and going to different restaurants. And I miss that. So I'm hoping that this might be appealing, as maybe there's some light at the end of the tunnel that at some point we can travel again. The premise of the show is that we have two hosts, Giles Corran, who we actually saw in our first show we talked about, Back in Time for Dinner, and Chef Monica Galletti. So they travel to some of sort of what the most unique hotels and explore what makes them different from anywhere else in the world. I watched a couple of episodes. The first one I chose is actually just in our backyard here in the province of Newfoundland and Labrador in Canada. They visited Fogo Island, which is a small island just off the coast. It's a few hours drive from the capital city here in the province. And it's actually just about 30 minutes from my grandparents' house. But what makes the inn interesting or indifferent is, long story short, there was a woman who grew up in the community, went away, became super rich and super successful, came back and built this amazing, beautiful hotel that is all about locally sourcing. And the hotel, everything in it is built by local artisans, and it's about employing the community. And that was what was really interesting about the show, actually, is how it's a little bit of the travel show, and it takes you through the hotel and you get all the beautiful visuals, but it really talks about the community and all of the properties that they visit and the hotels they talk to. It's really about the people who run it and make it appealing and make it interesting and the culture around it. So it's really about the community. And that was something that I found the Fogo Island episode was really interesting. Like I said, it's beautiful, but it's talking to all the people who live and work and make it special. And the second episode I watched too was Giraffe Manor in Kenya. So you go from, ooh, you know, the tundra here in cold Newfoundland, but what makes that unique and beautiful. But also then, you know, you get to wake up in the morning and feed giraffes from your balcony while you drink champagne. And I can't think of anything better to do. But like I said, there was a real sort of respect and appreciation for all the places that the hosts went to. They talked to, like I said, they talked to the people who were in housekeepers. They learned what it takes to run a safari and through when you were in Kenya and how you do that and how you become a licensed safari. And it was really beautiful to watch. It was wonderful to daydream about it again, but I really enjoyed the stories of what the people who are running these hotels do to make it sustainable and truly involve and give back to the community and make the community part of that hotel. And you could, from the couple episodes I watched, you could see that there was a lot of care taken into that to appreciate where these stories are coming from and what it looked like. So it was beautiful and wonderful and lovely to watch. And I really recommend, if you need a little bit of a feel good and some really pretty travel visions, I highly recommend Life Beyond the Lobby.
When we were in Kenya, we had to be escorted from the lobby to our room so we weren't attacked by animals. So, you know, there's a difference, I guess, between that and the happy giraffe morning.
One. Well, we were in a luxury camp.
But it was very nice, but I always enjoyed, like, just wait here. We'll get somebody to walk you to your room so you don't die. Anything to plug there, Alex?
I have nothing myself to plug, but I'd like to give just a quick shout out to the Great American Pop Culture Quiz Show.
Hey. Excellent choice.
How much I love that show is not going to be reflected in how poorly I do in game time later here today. But we're really enjoying it as a family. Even my teenage daughter and I will play along to the empty studio games when we have a little bit of a car trip. And aww, as a family, we've done the occasional sort of live studio versions, and highly recommend for anybody who hasn't joined that yet.
Oh, thank you. USA Quiz Show is the name of that site.com.
Yep.
Sarah D. Bunting, what did Heather want you to watch for Around the Dial?
Heather assigned me Escape to the Country, which she describes, quote, as an extremely low-pressure real estate show where a nice British host takes a nice couple to see three nice houses in the British countryside. Will they buy one? Not the point. They always drink tea. End quote. I really don't have much beyond that, because that's exactly what it is. The show is so, like, turbo soothing that I've already kind of forgotten everything about it, except that it was this episode, series 15, episode 30 of like 18 series. Wow. I mean, you can watch this forever if you want, and you might. This episode took place in North Wales. The presenter, and they've had a million presenters because it's been on since the Beeb was invented. The presenter is Sonali Shah. She has a series of fantastic coats, as British presenters tend to do. And they're sort of trooping all over North Wales. And it's exactly what you would expect from an American show of the same type, except that the houses are like much more like weird and individual. And the couple that's being shown around tends to not be dicks. Like, I mean, I think they just cast American couples on these shows to be a problem or a lot, because they think that's the watchable part, which I think is not accurate. But some of these houses, like this particular couple, the woman is like a compulsive side hustle starter. They want to retire to be closer to their daughter in Chester. She wants a big kitchen. Mm-hmm. So they see three houses. They guess the price. They pick one that is closest to their budget and also that they like the most. And then you get a little wrap up at the end. There's also a 45-minute version if you really want to know the ending, and a 60-minute version if you're really struggling with insomnia, that has like more footage of Welsh sheep. which who doesn't love that? They look very happy, these sheep. And some of them like come with the property, or you have like you lease the sheep and they mow the lawn.
Oh, sure.
And then you have like the option to buy them from a neighboring farmer.
And they're all named Llewellyn.
Yes, they are.
This all sounds wonderful.
It really was. Like just seeing these houses with personality and like two staircases feeding into the snug, I guess they call it, which is like their TV room, but then there's like a formal parlor. And the snugs are so cozy. There's so many exposed beams. But these are all houses that like some of them were built in the 17th century, but like they have all the modern appurtenances. Like no one is pooping in a moat that we saw, maybe the sheep. And the really wonderful thing about this, I thought, is that this is a show that like, if there are parts of it that you're sort of like, I don't care, you can sort of second screen. Like I'm not a person who needs any kitchen, basically. Like I can boil water and work a microwave, and that's about all that's asked of me. So when she's like, oh, I don't know about these appliances, I'm like, I don't care. And I'm playing a game on my phone. And then sometimes there's parts of the local history of the town that it's like, this is where the warp was invented and warp and weft weaving. And you're like, I thought I would care about that, but I don't. I'm playing a game on my phone. And then you come back to the part where the couple is guessing the price of things, which is like a, you know, The Price is Right. And I'm married to a real estate broker. Like these are things that I'm interested in. And you sort of dip back in from the game on your phone to the episode. But there's no, like, I just kept thinking like I wish there were an American version of this so that I could have a better concept of the pricing and the values of things. But also like Americans would ruin this because American television feels that you have to have aggro drama to make a show like this interesting. And that's really not true. They also don't, an American show would, I think, zhuzh the properties more. And these people, like the houses that are for sale, like sometimes they're decorated in a style that you like. And other times it's like 90s upstate New York, contempo aggressive, so chintzy, and you're like, wow. But I enjoy watching that. So this was fun. Like this is waiting room television. And I mean that as a high compliment. Like this is something that you can pay as much attention to or as little as you want. It's interesting without being melodramatic. No one's a dickhead.
House Hunters on HGTV sounds like this. And those places are indifferently decorated also.
Indifferently decorated is perfect. So I recommend, there's like a bunch of Wales episodes because there are seriously 7,000 episodes of the show. If you would like to begin, again, series 15, episode 30, Sonali Shah is perfect. There's never any crying except happy crying. And sheep, what's not to love? I have another podcast called Mark and Sarah Talk About Songs. You'll be shocked to learn that my friend Mark and I talk about songs. In upcoming episodes, we have, we are ranking a whole bunch of songs that Prince wrote but did not sing. This was our esteemed colleague John Ramos's idea, so he will be guesting on that episode, and you can learn more about that and the 224 other episodes we have done, not counting tournaments, at markandsarahtalkaboutsongs.com. Link in the show notes.
So when it came to nice British people doing nice things, I immediately thought of the stop motion show Postman Pat, Postman Pat, Postman Pat, Postman Pat, and his black and white cat. If you're not familiar with the extreme turbo gentleness of Postman Pat, gentleness. What I have done here is condensed I think, 20-minute episode down to almost just over 3 minutes.
Postman Pat, Postman Pat, and his black and white cat.
Good morning, Pat called. Morning, Pat, said Mrs. Goggins. Looks like a busy day for you. Lots of letters and parcels. Pat turned in at Greendale Farm. Katie and Tom saw him coming and ran to meet him. They're twins, you see, so it was a double birthday. Pat wished them a happy birthday. Tom's present was just what he wanted. But Katie didn't seem very pleased with hers.
"What's up with Katie?" asked Pat.
"She's wrong side out today," said Mrs. Pottage. "She's lost Pottage. Sarah Ann."
"Sarah Ann? Is that the little doll she takes to school?" "Don't worry, I'll look for Sarah Ann," said Pat. "I might come across her. I'm good at finding things, you know." "We'll get her smiling again, you'll see. Cheerio."
Pat told him about Katie's lost doll.
"Oh, she could have lost it in the church," said Reverend Timms. "She always brings it. Ah, well, seek and thou shalt find. Let's have a look."
"Found anything?" called Pat. At last, the Reverend Timms did find something, but it wasn't Sarah Ann. It was a lady's glove. It had the letters DT sewn inside. When Pat and Jess arrived at Thompson Ground, Mrs. Thompson was out with a basket, collecting the eggs. She was surprised when Pat gave her a glove with her letters. Then Pat told her about Katie's doll. Katie and her mother came to tea yesterday. She could have left her doll under a cushion. Mrs. Thompson found something, but it wasn't a doll. It was a penknife. "Hey, that looks like Ted Glenn's knife. See you tomorrow. Cheerio." Ted Glenn was delighted to see his knife.
"She was here yesterday with her mother. They brought a lamp to repair."
So they went to look in Ted's workshop. They didn't find the doll, but Ted found a watch that he'd forgotten he had. "That's Miss Hubbard's," he said.
"She brought it to be mended ages ago. She must have forgotten all about it. Would you take it for a pat?"
"Certainly. I'm going that way."
Miss Hubbard was shopping at Sam's mobile shop, whilst Sam was enjoying a cup of tea. Pat told them all about Katie's lost doll, but they hadn't seen it.
"Poor Katie," said Pat, "and on her birthday too."
"I know. I'll take her a box of chocolates. That'll cheer her up."
"Aha! Sarah Ann! So that's where you've been hiding all this time."
"It's Katie's doll," said Pat. "I found her when I wasn't looking for her, sitting behind the chocolates."
Pat feels he's a really happy man.
I thought that was going in a true crime direction when we got to the knife.
I know.
Watching too much Inspector Linley.
It is time for The Canon, the show picked by Heather. The person that has to argue for it, picked by Heather. That person is Tara. Tara, take it away. And remember, be convincing.
Yeah. So programming Extra Hot Grade includes choosing a canon episode and ordering one of the canonists to make the presentation for it. It's fallen to me. Heather has ordered me to make the case for Corner Gas, Season 4, Episode 18, called Happy Campers. So I lived in Canada when Corner Gas was on, and since it was a very successful homegrown sitcom, I was aware of it. I knew it was created by and starred Saskatchewan's own Brett Butt, a stand-up comic, and that it was set in a tiny town in Saskatchewan. I knew that Eric Peterson, formerly of 80s procedural Street Legal, played his dad, and that venerable Canadian actor Janet Wright, who has since died, we lost her, played his mom. I knew my mom liked and watched it because it was Canadian and she feels it's her legal obligation to watch every Canadian show.
True patriot.
Also a Bay Streeters fan.
Yeah. Bay Streeters is Street Legal. That's just what they called it in outside of Canada, Sarah. Also, it was set in Saskatchewan, where we're both from, and that's everything I knew about Corner Gas till I watched my very first episode two nights ago, which will in no way prevent me from making this canon presentation, because Heather gets what Heather wants. So here's what else I have learned about the show. Corner Gas ran for six acclaimed seasons, from 2004 to 2009, still airs widely in syndication. It also spawned a movie, Corner Gas : the movie, and an animated series, Corner Gas Animated, which aired its third season last year, but plays Brett Leroy, who owns and operates the titular gas station in fictional Dog River, Saskatchewan. It's the only place to get gas for kilometers and kilometers in every direction. Wanda works in the adjoining convenience store. There's also a diner next door operated by Toronto transplant Lacey, who inherited it from her late aunt. Other characters, in addition to Brett's parents, Oscar and Emma, include Hank, Brett's best friend, and Davis and Karen, local constables. So I guess I should start convincing you this is canon worthy. So here we go. Number one, Happy Campers rests on a classic sitcom premise. As the episode opens, we learn it's time for Brett and Oscar to go on their annual camping trip. Lacey is suspicious about this since Brett does not strike her as the outdoorsy type, but this trip is very important to both father and son, they insist. Overhearing, Davis tries to see if he can join them. They refuse, but a nearby Emma hears and makes them bring him as well. Not until they're out of town or possibly just a few blocks away from the Leroy house does the truth come out. Oscar and Brett hate camping, but Emma has made such a big deal about their spending time together that they fake it for her benefit. Actually, they go to the city and split up to enjoy their own pastimes. Oscar goes to the library and reads magazines. Brett plays D&D in some weirdo's basement. Initially, the Leroys just figure they'll bring Davis with them to the city and let him do whatever he wants during the allotted time away. But then they remember he has such a big mouth, he got someone in witness protection killed, so they're going to have to go camping for real. And when we see the Leroys at the campsite, we understand why they gave up on this charade, because they really hate everything about it. And Davis's enthusiasm for it does nothing to change their minds. Brett can't stand his mattress. They don't want to portage the canoe anywhere. Even when Davis makes campfire, Oscar is convinced the smoke from the campfire is targeting him specifically. Even when Davis makes campfire waffles, Brett and Oscar are such childish brats that Davis tries to ditch them, becoming the third and final member of the camping party to make such an attempt. To the city they go, and maybe Davis has learned a valuable lesson, not about camping perhaps, which he could still enjoy under the right circumstances, but about inviting himself places. Number two. Actually, Happy Campers rests on two classic sitcom premises. When Wanda stops by the diner and tries to hurry Lacey along with her tuna melt and fries because she's got to get right back to the gas station, she's busy, busy, busy with Brett out of town. Lacey scoffs at the idea that she could even claim one busy, never mind three. Wanda shoots back that Lacey's job is easier than Wanda's could ever be, given the unsophisticated palates of her customers. Before long, it's Wanda behind the counter at the Ruby taking Hank's order. Clip one.
What can I get you?
I'll have a, Wait a minute, what are you doing?
Lacey and I were arguing over whose job was harder, so we switched.
You mean like on Gilligan's Island or something?
Instead of getting the two of them to settle which has the tougher job, the episode heightens the B-plot premise with a second heightening. Karen, criticizing Wanda's bland mac and cheese, volunteers to take over for her. She's a small-town cop and doesn't really have much else to do. And when Emma actually needs gas and has to show Lacey where to get it from, she ends up taking over at the gas station. Apparently, she has nothing she would prefer to do with her retirement. By the end of the episode, she comments she did a better job at the gas station than Lacey and that Karen outperformed Wanda at the Ruby, not that either Wanda or Lacey seems to hear her. Number three, there's some good comedy editing. Most of Hank's storyline is visual. He happens to have a great hair day and forgoes his trademark backwards baseball cap to show it off, so we don't have to talk too much about it. But the juxtaposition of everything going right for him on his good hair day, playing with an adorable puppy, catching an apple from an admirer, cheering up a boy in the hospital, and everything curdling when his hair goes back to normal, is well done. The edits on Lacey's memories of the dumb decisions that preceded her taking over at Corner Gas, including giving away baby turtles with pies, renting the extended version of The Lord of the Rings, and moving to Dog River, was also nicely done. And number four, some good jokes. As when Brett and Oscar tell Davis the truth about the trip, clip two.
I mean, we don't have to make waffles the first night. The first night we can have beans. Then in the morning we can have waffles. I brought maple syrup, but I didn't bring blueberry syrup because I thought camping, we're roughing it.
We're not going camping, jackass.
Huh? He said we're not going camping. And then he called you a jackass. But you said we were going camping. We're wearing camping clothes.
You really think we'd go camping? Together? With each other?
Who do you think we are? Opie and Opie's dad, the sheriff, Matlock?
I mean, who does know that guy's name? And when Oscar explains the attraction of the library, clip three.
I got my library buddies there.
Those guys are hobos.
Hobos ride trains. These guys are intellectuals. Roddy and Patches and Shy Pete.
They call Oscar Dimples. That Davids never figures out for what purposes the Leroys want him to dig himself a very large hole is also pretty good, given that, you know, he's a cop. And number five, quality Saskatchewan content. As I said up top, I am from Saskatchewan. And though I haven't lived there since 1989, I am still excited whenever it gets mentioned in pop culture because it does not happen much. But this episode of a show that is both set and filmed in the province has lots of small touches to make me feel at home, from the local maps behind the counter at the gas station to the Hawkins cheesies, Dave, to Brett's rider's cap in a very classy muted shade and not a garish rider green, no less, all warmed my dry and dusty prairie heart. I also felt personally pandered to by Oscar's intense desire to get to the library and read magazines, having worked in a public library as a teen, and given the well-documented magazine addiction I grapple with to this day. Brett is right, though. Libraries are a popular gathering place for hobos. Dave and I originally watched this episode after midnight on a weekday, and I would be remiss if I didn't add that the mere mention of diner grilled cheese and fries didn't make us both drool. It's been too long, diners, but we will see you soon. In conclusion, Corner Gas is a show that lots of Canadians and people around the world, I guess, but primarily Canadians, really loved and continue to love, and camping continues to suck. If you agree with these facts, maybe you will induct this episode into the canon.
Thank you, Tara. All right, Corner Gas, number one fan, Alex Collins.
Well, I do have
what
to...
What did you think?
I have to say, I have not watched Corner Gas before. My experience with Corner Gas was, I think we watched on the comedy channel in Canada. Simpsons used to run after Corner Gas. So like the recording on the PVR, we'd get the theme song. So that was my full experience with Corner Gas, was just the end of the theme song on the credits. And so my criteria going into this, because my understanding of it, though, it was just kind of a cheesy sitcom that I never had any interest in watching. So... Before we came into this, I said, I'm going to, you know, come in with an open mind. And as long as it's something that I feel like at the end of it makes me feel like, yeah, I could have watched it, or maybe I'll try it again, and maybe it might be something I'd be interested in trying, then it might be a successful canon pitch. I do not feel that way. I also lived in Saskatchewan for a time and hold that fairly close to my heart. I think the city we lived in, Moose Jaw, was quite close actually to where they filmed Corner Gas. But I just couldn't do it. I laughed at you pretty much brought up all the same jokes that I found pretty funny and made note of Tara. But it was just a little bit slow and kind of corny. And there were a few good jokes that stood out. But I find Canadian comedy is better when it's a little bit more biting. I mean, that's when Canadian comedy really does it so well. And that's what I was missing here, is the few jokes were good and they were darker than I thought it was going to be for this show. A few of the, you know, the joke about Davis getting the guy in witness protection killed, I thought was really funny and quite unexpected, and then getting him to dig his own grave, same thing. But it wasn't great. I didn't love it. It was just a little bit too corny, a little bit too cheesy, and just really not funny enough for me. But I appreciate the take back to Saskatchewan and seeing the prairies again, because I haven't seen them in a long, long time. So that was really nice.
Sarah D. Bunting.
I also am crazy dorsy, like one of our protagonists. What was that sitcom that I think they also were sitting around a gas station and we had to watch it for the canon in the last couple of months?
Oh, Letterkenny.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, Letterkenny. This reminded me of Letterkenny. And not in ways that were necessarily good. I did not hate this. I also noted many of the same jokes that Tara noted in her excellent and very determined presentation. I expected to hate this. I deliberately didn't research anything. There were notes in our rundown doc about how I was clearly going to despise this, and I just tried to stay away from any information about it because I didn't want to be influenced. But from the first frame, like, it just looks extremely budget-minded, and that tends to bode ill for me with sitcoms. That it's like if it looks this fugazi, then it's not going to be good in other ways. But that was a sort of outlier as far as the quality, because this was fine. Some of the surreal runners are fun. Like the turtles with pie joke is like, it's cheap and low hanging pie fruit, but it, you know, I chuckled. The grave thing was dark and unexpected and funny, but the pacing is very static and pleased with itself. It reminded me of Letterkenny in the sense that I felt like this was a daisy chain of bits that were not run together close enough to make a really sort of dazzling necklace. I have lost control of this metaphor, but here's the point. It was just like there was too much air and waiting for the laugh. And as such, that does not rise to canon for me. I was not offended at having had to watch this. I was, however, relieved that I was not responsible for presenting it. And I will put Tara in the canon, but this is a no for me. Prairie Dogs.
Dave. Yeah, Sarah, I think a lot of what you're saying kind of comes down to this. Corner Gas is a show that, in its DNA, wanted to have a laugh track, but somehow didn't. It's like, Here comes the joke. That was the joke. We told the joke. Corner Gas.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I won't say. I can't undercut my own presentation, and I won't, because I believe in it.
Yeah, you won't anymore. Okay. Maybe it's just because we could see your face, but... Yeah.
No, you can't.
Did not grow up in Saskatchewan, but I married somebody from Saskatchewan. And I will say, Hawkins Cheesies taste like a big bag of terrible chemicals.
You go to hell.
The problem with this show is that...
Impolite fight.
...is just very indicative of Canadian sitcoms, which is instantly forgettable, bland, and not very challenging. That's sort of like what Canada does when it comes to comedies, for the most part. It is the Rita McNeil of Canadian sitcoms, if you will.
Wow. Shots fired at Rita
CanCon.
Yeah.
Jesus.
And the exact same problem with Corner Gas, the animated show, which I watched one of, which is the exact same show, except they don't move as much. So let's put this to the official vote. Alex Collins, canon worthy or not?
Great presentation. Thank you very much, but going to have to say no.
Sarah D. Bunting?
As they say in degrees Celsius, no.
This is one of the worst canon presentations I've heard in a long time. Shame on you, Tara Ariana.
What? Wow.
Jesus.
That means Corner Gas. Tara's hurt. Season 4.
I really tried.
Episode 18. Happy Campers. I was pretending you really liked the show. Happy Campers. Okay. You're hereby not inducted into the Extra Hot Great Canon.
Oh, God.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
The episode programming continues with winner and loser of the year 1992. Sarah has this year's winner.
I sure do. It is New York City, both because New York One, which is now called Spectrum Cable News One, but fuck out of here, with its own state bird, Canadian Pat Kiernan, launched on September 8th of 1992. I didn't realize it was that long ago. And as well, Seinfeld episode The Contest, often considered the best episode of any sitcom, on these lists, aired on November 18th of 1992. So pretty New York-y stuff. I'm going to say New York City.
Loser of the year?
Another city, Vatican City, because the notorious Sinead O'Connor rips up a picture of the Pope and says, fight the real enemy on SNL. That airs October 3rd, and it's another incident where you look back on it and think, oh, wow, we made fun of her at the time, but wow, she was super-duper right, turns out. Whoops. Mm. Mm-hmm.
About a lot of things.
Yeah. Speaking about being right, and then whoops, you know what time it is?
It's your welcome time.
Welcome back to Game Time. This is the fifth Game Time of the season. The season scores are whatever they were at the end of last week's episode. Today we are playing You've Got Mail from our programmer Heather with the help of @EHGAssist.
Thanks, guys.
You've Got Mail. I will give you a street address and you tell me what show it is from. If you need help, you can ask for a hint and I'll give you the name of the neighbor or a neighbor.
Okay.
2 points for the correct answer off the bat. 1 point after the hint. One guess only. Mm. We're recording this out of order. So steel meals don't really apply because we don't know how many you have. So I'm giving everybody 2 steel meals that expire today. So you can use up to 2 if you so wish. So with that, let's throw it to Picky to see who will be going first.
We will start with valued guest.
All right. Our order today is Alex, Sarah, Tara. Are we ready to play You've Got Mail?
Yes, sir.
Yes.
Do it.
Corn cob curtains in the kitchen at 742 Evergreen Terrace, Springfield. What is that show?
Thank God. The Simpsons.
2 points off the bat. Sarah
Starting
D. Bunting.
Strong.
Conspiracy and autoerotic asphyxiation are commonplace at 42-2630 Hegel Place.
Hegel?
Yeah. Or perhaps Hegel. H-E-G-A-L.
Okay. I need a hint, please.
One of the neighbors could be the smoking man.
Oh, the X-Files.
That's where Fox Mulder lives. Tara?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Who are you calling a painted lady? 1882 Girard Street, San Francisco, California is a Victorian.
Full House.
Full House is the correct answer. Back to Alex. A smarty pants lives at 221B Baker Street, London, not in his mind palace.
Is it Sherlock Holmes?
Sherlock. The Sherlock. Show. We're looking for the show is the answer. Then we'll give you that one for Sherlock. Sarah D. Bunting. It's a constant push and pull between neat and messy at 1049 Park Avenue, New York, New York.
Odd Couple?
Correct. Tara?
Yep.
These cousins live at 711 Calhoun Street, Chicago, Illinois.
Perfect Strangers.
Back to Alex. You can send a thank you letter for your friend at 6151 Richmond Street, Miami, Florida.
The Golden Girls.
Back to Sarah D. Bunting. This pineapple is located at 124 Conn Street, Bikini Bottom, Pacific Ocean.
Oh, SpongeBob SquarePants.
Ding, ding. Tutara.
Yep.
The class protector lives at 1630 Ravello Drive, Sunnydale, California.
Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Back to Alex. Pizza delivery for 308 Negra Arroyo Lane, Albuquerque, New Mexico. I'll just leave it on the roof.
Breaking Bad.
Sarah D. Bunting. I couldn't help but wonder, did I live at 245 East 73rd Street, New York, New York?
Not on that salary. Sex in the City.
Tara?
Yep.
This blended family lived in a house designed by the dad at 4222 Clinton Way, Los Angeles, California.
The Brady Bunch.
Alex. Groovy tunes may come from the garage at 698 Sycamore Road, San Pueblo, California.
The Partridge Family?
Yes.
Wow.
Nice guess.
Sarah D. Bunting. You can visit or come to 15 Robin Hood Lane, Huntington, New York for your therapy session.
Visit or come to Huntington, New York. I need a hint, please.
Your neighbor could very well be Richard Milhouse Boner Stabone, a.k.a. Boner.
Boner. Oh, my God. What show was Boner on? Doogie Howser? Wrong one.
The answer there, nobody steel milling that one, is Growing Pains. Growing Pains.
Yeah, it was one or the other, and I guessed wrong.
I always think Boner is from Family Ties for some reason.
That's Skippy.
Skippy.
Skippy. I hope Skippy isn't in this game.
I know.
Tara. Yep. Take us into our first score break. You can have a baby delivered downstairs at 10 Stigwood Avenue, New York City, New York.
The Cosby Show. The
Cosby Show is correct. All right, that takes us into our first score break. Scores, please start.
It's a very close game. Sarah D. Bunting has 7 points. Alex and I are tied with 10 points each.
All right, that means you guys are going to go. I have for you a choice of old TV box, pop culture 2 TV box, or the 90s box.
Pop culture 2, please.
Okay.
Is this for 2 points or 4 points?
This is for 4 points.
Woo! Good luck, Sarah.
Thanks.
What Sex and the City character's wine-stained Bagley Mitschke wedding dress fetched? Did I butcher that? $5,600 at a 2004 auction. What character?
2004 auction?
Mm.
Yeah. Wine-stained.
Which character's wedding dress?
I'm going to say Charlotte.
You're correct. What HBO series subjected its lead character to a bite in the crotch from a German shepherd?
Arliss?
Curb your enthusiasm.
Oh. Okay.
What series did songbird Vonda Shepherd warble classics on for 5 years?
Ally McBeal.
I only need one more. What dancer leapt at the chance to play artist Alexander Petrovsky on Sex and the City? Wow, lots of Sex and the City.
Jesus. Damn. Mikhail Baryshnikov.
There are your points.
Take
them. Boom, bam, to the top. Here we go, back to it with Alex. This studio apartment features a sunken living room area and a nosy landlady. Visit D119 North Weatherly Avenue, Minneapolis, Minnesota.
I'm going to need the hint, please.
Your neighbor may be Rhoda Morgenstern.
Is that Laverne and Shirley?
Oh, Alex is so young.
It is not.
I'm sorry.
Steel Mill.
Steel Mill from Sarah.
Mary Tyler Moore Show.
That is good for 1 point. This is question 17 for you, Sarah.
Spread Eagle.
Watch your step at 167 Hemdale Street, Los Angeles, California. The floor was famously full of trap doors to accommodate the puppeteers.
Hint.
Raquel Achmanek.
That does not help. The Muppets.
Anybody?
Elf.
Okay, you should have steel-milled that, Tara. I don't know what you're doing, but that is correct. That buzzes for your poor strategy. That was Elf.
Damn.
You are correct. Tara.
Yep.
565 North Clinton Drive, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, is the house Howard's Hardware Store built.
Happy Days.
Correct. This is question 19. It is for Alex. This reminds me of the time we did a cutaway to 13 Spooner Street, Quahog, Rhode Island.
Family Guy?
Yes, Family Guy is correct.
We are all tied up!
Woo! All right. Sarah D. Bunting, the elevator is usually broken, so you'll have to take the stairs to 4A 2311 North Los Robles Avenue, Pasadena, California.
Hint.
Your neighbor may be Penny.
Big Bang Theory?
Yes, correct.
Didn't know that was in L.A. We'll forget that immediately.
They go to Caltech. Yeah.
Tara.
Yep.
Making your way to 112A and a half, Beacon Street, Boston, Massachusetts today takes everything you got.
Well, whose place is it? I'm going to guess.
I didn't say it was a residence. I said it's an address.
Oh, okay. Then it's Cheers.
Correct. Alex, nothing happens at apartment 5A, 129 West 81st Street, New York.
I need the hint, please.
Newman.
Oh, Seinfeld.
Now I'm
Yeah.
Sometimes When 425 Grove Street, apartment 20, New York, New York is quiet, you can hear nearby quacking.
Quacking? Hint.
One of your neighbors may be Mr. Heckles.
DuckTales? I don't know. Mr. Heckles.
The answer there is Friends. Friends.
Oh.
Friends. Tara.
Yep.
California is the place they gotta be. 518 Crestview Drive, Beverly Hills, California, that is.
Beverly Hills 90210?
It's Hillcrest, I think. Oh. Oops, sorry.
Okay. Steel Meal,
you're welcome.
Anyone?
The answer there, Beverly Hillbillies.
Oh. Ugh. I thought that theme song, that sounded like Green Acres, so I got confused.
But it's not.
Okay.
Alex. No matter how many times you rearrange the furniture, the damn ottoman is always in the way at 148 Bonnie Meadow Road, New Rochelle, New York.
Hint, please.
Millie and Jerry Helper may be next door to you on this show.
Pass.
Damn ottoman? No. Anybody? That is the Dick Van Dyke Show. The Dick Van Dyke Show.
Right.
Just to remind you, you all have two steel meals which expire today. I don't know why you're not using them. Sarah D. Bunting, follow the sounds of a loudly hooting studio audience to 9764 Jeopardy Lane or 9674 Jeopardy Lane, Chicago, Illinois.
Jeopardy Lane.
Yeah.
Okay. Hint.
Marcy Darcy. Loudly hooting studio audience.
Yeah, Marcy Darcy. I don't know.
Steel Meal.
Steel Meal from Alex.
Married with Children.
Married with Children. Good for 1 point on this steel.
Okay.
All right, Tara, take us into our second score break.
Yeah.
This couple lives up, up and away at 1938 Sullivan Lane, Metropolis, USA. What's that show?
The Adventures of Lois and Clark.
I'm sorry. It's Lois and Clark, The New Adventures of Superman.
Okay.
We're not going to give that to you.
Fair enough.
You know why? Because I'm upset you're not using your steel meals. That's why. It's come back to bite you. Scores, please, Tara.
Well, it's even closer than before because now Sarah D. Bunting has 13 points and Alex and I are still tied, but now with 14 points.
All right. Guess what? That means it's time I get for the...
It's good to see.
Thank God for these.
You know, if you could really fine-tune your points, you can really play this to your advantage. I choose to believe that is what is happening here. What's your box picks? Super old, pop culture, or 90s?
We're talking about my super old box. Pop culture, please.
Same one? Okay.
Yeah.
Good luck, Sarah!
Thanks!
What future Detroit Pistons star dons Sleestak garb for an episode of Land of the Lost?
What future Detroit... Pistons. Yes. Star.
Yes.
Oh. Fuck.
Any idea?
Dennis Rodman.
Bill Laimbeer.
Oh, that motherfucker.
What two words began the titles of 236 Friends episodes?
The one where.
The one. Yes, correct.
Whatever.
TV. What sitcom gave the world the suspender-wearing uber nerd Steve Urkel? What's happening? Steve Urkel from what show?
Oh, God. It's not just the 10 of us. Is it just the 10 of us?
It is not. It's Family Matters. Family Matters. All right. You've got one right. This is your fourth question. What Friends spinoff did psychic Kenny Kingston predict would flop after consulting with the spirit of the late Milton Berle?
Joey?
Correct. What is the divination method where you feel a dead guy's giant dick?
I really feel like that was going around the block to get to the house next door with that prediction, yeah. But okay.
All right. Two questions and one of these right.
Yeah.
What soap opera spoof from the 70s was known to diehard fans as MH2?
what, soap opera spoof from the 1970s?
Correct. Was known to diehard fans as MH2.
Soap?
Mary Hartman.
All right. Sarah D. Bunting, I have one question left for you. You must get this right to get your points. I'm feeling that is probably not going to happen for you. Here's why. What character suffered his first panic attack after seeing his daddy chop off a butcher's finger?
Thanks for the verse jinx, buddy. Tony Soprano Sr.
You are correct, Tony Soprano, and you get your points so quickly, Tara. Update the scores.
Okay, well, Alex and I are still tied with 14 points each, but now Sarah D. Bunting has a very comfortable lead with 17.
All right, there's still
Thanks for the unreverse jinx.
There's still a lot of game to be played. We're going to drive through the rest of it quickly. The Regal Beagle, Alex. The Regal Beagle is just down the street from 834 Ocean Vista Avenue, number 201 Santa Monica, California.
I'm going to need the hint, please.
So young.
Oh, my God.
Larry Dallas.
His last name is Dallas?
Yeah.
Dallas?
Any idea?
No idea.
I got to do it. Steel Meal.
Here we go. Steel Meal from Tara.
Three's Company.
Three's Company is correct.
Yeah.
Sarah, spend all day standing by the fence just outside 84 Rainy Street, Ardland, Texas.
King of the Hill?
Yes, King of the Hill. Tara.
I was like, hold on, improvement.
This East Coast transplant's auntie and uncle took him in at 508 St. Cloud Road, Bel Air, L.A.
The Fresh Prince of Bel Air.
You are correct. Alex. House features include a famous chair and a famous toilet that actually flushes. 705 Hauser Street, Queens, New York, New York.
Why are you giving Alex all the ones from 700 years before she was born?
Oh, wait. Don't give me the hint. The Archie Bunker, what the hell is that called? All right, give me the hint.
George Jefferson is the neighbor. You were on the right track.
I can't remember the name of that.
She's all in.
I'm not going to be able to come up with it.
That is all in the family.
Damn it.
All in the family. All right, back to Sarah. There's a big fucking egg at 1619 Pine Street, Boulder, Colorado. There's a big fucking egg at 1619 Pine Street, Boulder, Colorado.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that was a big fucking egg. That threw me off, though. I was like, Deadwood? It's not Deadwood. It's Mork and Mindy.
If only it was. Tara.
Yep.
Watch out. There is often loud crying or smoke coming from the kitchen at 4A 623 East 68th Street, New York, New York.
Hint.
Ethel Mertz.
Oh, I Love Lucy.
Correct.
Oh, wow. Picky.
All right.
That was rude.
You want to talk about giving Alex the old ones? Here we go.
Awesome.
Lunar tinned spousal abuse is commonplace at 328 Chauncey Street, Brooklyn, New York.
Hang on, I know it.
Lunar tinned spousal abuse. That's
the
a great phrase. The
honeymooners.
No. Hey.
Sarah D. Bunting. A curving staircase in 900 Park Avenue, New York, New York. The owner is definitely a man of means.
Picky.
Say it right.
Yes.
Why am I getting yelled at now?
I'm just saying, say it right.
I complimented your canon presentation.
You did.
It might not have been for everyone. That's why we say different strokes.
Correct. Tara.
Yes.
Do not go visit this writer at 698 Candlewood Lane, Cabot Cove, Maine, because there is a good chance you will be murdered.
Murder, She Wrote.
Correct. Back to Alex. In a way, every episode was a bottle episode at 1020 Palm Drive, Cocoa Beach, Florida.
Nah.
Bottle episode. Big air quotes.
Miami Vice?
I don't know.
That is...
I love that guess.
Anybody? That is I dream of Jeannie.
Oh, cute.
Sarah DeBunting. This nanny and his daughter moved to 3344 Hill Oaks Drive, Fairfield, Connecticut.
Can you read the first part again, please?
This nanny and his daughter moved to 3344 Oak Hills Drive, Fairfield, Connecticut.
Hint.
Diane Wilmington may be collecting your mail when you're not around.
Feeding the cat. I'm sure that's super nice of that person who's on Benson.
Steel mail. Alex, go ahead.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
Who's the boss?
Is correct.
Oh,
stealing that point there. All right, Tara, take us into our last score break. Just snap your fingers twice and you'll be at the creepy family home at 1313 Cemetery Lane.
The Addams Family.
You are correct. Nice. All right, that'll take us into a score break. Everybody has two questions left.
Okay, it's real close. Alex has 17 points. I have 22 points. Sarah DeBunting has 23.
All right, Alex, guess what? You are in the Grossworth Equalizer Challenge Zone. Your chance to get 4 points. Here we go. Now, Alex, you can have the super old 80s box, the slightly newer early aughts box, or the 1990 themed 1990s box.
I think based on how today is going, we're going to go with the 90s box.
Okay. You get additional information with these because we have the year that each card is about. So I'll read you that before I read you the TV question. Are you ready?
Yes.
Good luck.
Good luck.
Thank you.
1995. What Saved by the Bell star proves she could take off her clothes in the movie Showgirls? That's mean. But
Elizabeth Berkeley.
Elizabeth Berkeley is correct. 1994. Which cast member of Friends underwent a name change in the credits midway through the series?
Courtney Cox Arquette.
Correct. 1993. What Cheers character's beer bill at the end of 11 seasons was totaled at $64,218, according to TV Guide?
Norm?
Correct. Those are your points.
Nice.
There's three more questions to go. If you get the next three correct, we will double that amount to a whopping 8 points.
Let's do it.
1994. What Revenge of the Nerds survivor landed a starring role on ER?
Anthony Edwards?
Yes, Anthony Edwards.
Damn. I did not think he would know that.
1992. What step does Michael Jackson teach Michael Jordan in the video of Jam?
The moonwalk?
The moonwalk is correct.
Oh my God.
One more for a rare sweep.
It's happening.
1991. What sitcom capped a decade of shows with the final words, "Sorry, we're closed"?
Cheers.
Sweep.
That is a sweep of the 90s TV questions. We're adding eight points to
coming
Alex's total.
So my on the backstretch.
Wow.
Holy shit.
What are the updated scores, Tara?
Well, I still have 22. Sarah still has 23, but now Alex has 25.
All right.
Fancy.
Here we go. Mathematically, anybody could win. Everybody has two questions. Back to Alex. A rolling robot usually answers a door at Venus 1234 Skypad Apartments, Orbit City in the 21st century.
The Jetsons?
The Jetsons is good for 2 points. Sarah DeBunting. A glass of sherry and a worn yet comfortable recliner are waiting for you at 1901 Elliott Bay Towers, Seattle, Washington.
Frasier.
It is.
And I should know.
Correct. Tara.
Yes.
Oh my God, a tornado just hit 4355 Wisteria Lane, Fairview.
Desperate Housewives.
Yes. All right, everybody's last question.
Oh.
This is for you, Alex. A family of three lives at 342 Gravel Pit Terrace with their purple pet.
The Flintstones?
The Flintstones is correct.
Oh, shit.
Sarah D. Bunting?
Yeah.
The owner added the B to her address in a nod to a literary hero with a shared profession. That address, 221B, the Esplanade in St. Kilda.
Hint.
Bert and Cecil. No, you don't.
No, I don't.
Like Miss Fisher's Mysteries or something?
Miss Fisher's Murder Mysteries, yeah. Oh,
okay.
All right, last question for Tara.
Good for her.
Yeah.
Grab a brew and head down to 730 Knapp Avenue, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, to meet these best girlfriends.
This is Laverne and Shirley.
That is Laverne and Shirley. That is
there
correct. And that is regulation. Exciting game. Let's hear the final score, Sarah.
Okay. Wow, it was a really close game. Sarah finished with 25 points. I had 26, but Alex is our victor with 28.
Wow.
Thanks, 90s. You're the best.
I love you the most.
I have the tiebreaker here that will play for a future steel mill. First person to shout out the show wins that steel mill. Here we go. The closets at 73 Essex Drive in Denver have to be big to fit all those shoulder pads.
Dynasty.
Dynasty is correct, but today belongs to our value guess.
Valued guest.
Well done. Well
done. I've never been so happy.
Man, the Equalizer Zone really ping-ponged those scores around.
No kidding.
It was exciting. Well,
was.
That is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We gobbled up Back in Time for Dinner before going around the dial with stops at Escape to the Chateau, Amazing Hotels, Escape to the Country, and Postman Pat. Tara gave us all corner gas for the cannon. We crowned winners and losers of the week. And Alex was the winner of this week's Game Time from Heather with an assist from at EHG Assist. Next up, it's stuff on Extra, Extra Hot, Great. And the next EHG Prime, you guessed it, more stuff. Remember.
We're listening.
I am David T. Cole. And on behalf of Tara Ariano.
Salt.
Tara, what? Sarah D. Bunting.
It's like the whole kitchen is mocking me.
And Alex Collins.
I hated it. I wasn't good at it. And I didn't get paid for it.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot Great.
Hey, I'd better be on my way. They'll be looking out for me. Well, I'll be off. Goodbye.